Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Nada Hashemi, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Kobel School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of Islam, Secularism, and Liberal Democracy, Towards a Democratic Theory for Muslim Societies, and The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. His latest book out soon is The Syria Dilemma. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nada Hashemi.
Thank you.
And the president, Hassan Rouhani, Iran's new president, has called for serious and substantive negotiations to end the standoff with the P5+1 over Iran's nuclear program. Is he a new face on the same government? Is there anything here to hope that this long impasse will be broken?
Well, I think there is, I think, room for some very cautious optimism, but I think it has less to do with the figure of Hassan Rouhani, who is an interesting person in and of his own capacity. But I think the reason why there is some cautious optimism is because it seems as if the senior Iranian leadership is hurting under these sanctions, that there is a sense in Iran among the senior leadership that the prognosis for the economy, for the country, is a disaster unless the sanctions can be lifted. And, of course, the sanctions can't be lifted and won't be lifted until there's some resolution of the nuclear question. So it seems that based on the press conference today, that Rouhani has been given the green light to try and engage in, as he said, serious and substantive talks with the United States to resolve this question.
So when Rouhani said that the United States had not responded in an appropriate and practical manner after June's presidential election, he was asked several times at the press conference, which is largely most of his questions came from foreign reporters and from a few local reporters. By the way, he did not take any questions from reporters from the conservative Iranian press, but he was asked several times about a possible thaw with the United States, and he was reminded of what the White House spokesman Jay Carney said, that the Iranian government would find a willing partner in the United States if it was willing to engage substantively and seriously to meet its international obligations and find a peaceful solution to this issue. But then Rouhani said the U.S.'s practical actions are more important to us, not their statements. And then he went on to talk about how the U.S. essentially was taking orders from a warmongering group opposed to talks, which was taking orders from a foreign country, obviously a reference to Israel.
Right. I think the reference there was to the new round of sanctions that have been passed by the Congress. I mean, obviously, there's a distinction that we make here in the United States between the White House and the Congress. But since his election, there has been a new round of sanctions that have been passed against Iran by the Congress. And, of course, that has upset the Iranian regime. And I think that's what he was referring to. So there's sort of two voices that I think the Iranian regime is hearing, one from the White House that seems more conciliatory and open to dialogue, but one from the Congress that seems to be very different, and I think that specifically was what he was referring to.
And of course, these new round of sanctions that the Congress just passed would make it even more difficult for Iran to access foreign oil revenues, which is really how these sanctions are finally abiding, aren't they? They're smuggling their oil through Iraq, but they can't find ways to get paid easily.
Right. I mean, the whole thing is a big mess, and the regime knows it. I mean, the sort of reports that have been published and statements by the incoming government, and if you read between the lines, there's a general recognition that the Ahmadinejad administration has been much more has mastered the art of mismanagement more than anyone could ever imagine, and that the economic sort of prospects and prognosis is far worse than anyone sort of had predicted. So there's a general sense that if things continue as usual, unless there's some radical change, radical departure from Iran's current policies and vice versa from the policies of the international community toward Iran, that the short term and the long term look very bleak, and that something has to change. And I think that's really at the root of this desire to try and re-engage with the international community to find a way out of this problem.
Again, I'm speaking with Nad Hashemi, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. And his latest book out soon is The Syria Dilemma, speaking of which the president of Iran at his press conference today said about the ongoing civil war in Syria that, quoting, "In Syria, we condemn terrorism, foreign intervention, and sending arms." Well, isn't that the pot calling the kettle black? I mean, what's going on there?
I mean, there was two things that sort of struck me in the press conference that were just gross exaggerations, and that as two statements that were cannot be morally, I think, defended. One was the Syria statement. Here, Iran is sort of backing to the hilt, you know, the Assad regime, sustaining it, supporting it, arming it, allowing its ally Hezbollah to come to the rescue of a dying regime. And then at the same time, in the same breath, Rouhani is claiming that there should not be external intervention. What he really meant to say was that there should not be external intervention in Syria except for us. So it's just a laughable statement that no one, I think, Syria takes seriously. The other sort of laughable and really objectionable statement that he made in the press conference was when he referred to his own election, and he used the phrase that the as a result of the election that brought him to power, democracy has been consolidated in Iran, and there's a dynamic political sort of democracy that has now taken shape. I mean, that's a joke. His election was the unfreest and unfairest election in the history of the Islamic Republic. And so I think one can't take those statements very, very seriously. But you're absolutely right on the Syria question. I think the only people who buy into those statements are, hardcore ideologues of either the Iranian regime or the Assad regime.
Well, there's a theory out there that that part of the U.S. strategy. One of the theories is that the U.S. strategy in Syria is similar to what Henry Kissinger remarked about the 8-year-long Iran-Iraq war, which was, it's a pity both sides can't lose, and that there's a certain cynicism that that what's happening there are the Al-Qaeda people are killing off the Alawite thugs that support this ruling family, the Assads, and a plague on both of their houses. Another theory that's also been floated recently is that Syria could become Iran's Vietnam. So is there anything to that possibility that both Israel and the United States are sort of happy to see Iran drawn deeper and deeper, and Hezbollah as well? Because my understanding is it's costing Iran considerable amount of money, not to mention materiel, and they're actually sending soldiers as well, is my understanding.
Yeah, that's correct. I don't think my own reading of U.S. foreign policy towards Syria is not as, I think, conspiratorial or sort of comprehensive along the lines that you sort of have outlined and that sometimes you hear in certain political constituencies.
Sure.
Here in the United States on the left. I think the United States, if you listen to the statements, if you listen to the public record and you read sort of those statements closely, it's pretty clear that the major motivating factor on behalf of the Obama administration with respect to Syria policy is really the legacy of the quagmire in Iraq and Afghanistan. There's no war appetite in this country. There's no desire to get involved in another Middle Eastern war. If you recall, at the time of the Libya uprising, the United States really had to be dragged kicking and screaming into that event. It was really the Europeans who were pushing, and the Obama administration reluctantly at the end signed on to the project, and they were happy that Gaddafi fell, but they were getting very nervous 6 months after the bombing had started that there was no sign that the regime was going to capitulate. And so with respect to Syria, I think the parallel that I draw and the sort of the images that I have is really with the Balkans in the 1990s and the Clinton administration. You know, there was massive human rights violations. There was a sense that there was a lot of moral reasons to intervene, but Clinton back then, just like Obama right now, did not feel that vital U.S. Strategic interests were at stake, and so they were prepared to simply stand on the sidelines and try and put on a brave face. But really, they didn't want to get involved because they feared of getting dragged into another war that had no end in sight. So I think that's really the motive. It's really my reading of it. It's just a basic, narrow sort of realpolitik calculation on what's in it for the United States. And it's better to just, as long as the conflict can be contained within Syria's borders, a little bit of spill out in Lebanon and Turkey, but the hope is that it won't get any worse than it already is, that things can simply sort of continue and the United States need not sort of devote more time and energy on this question than they have to. So I think that's really my reading of it. I haven't seen any evidence that there's a Kissingerian sort of desire to sort of drag Iran into a Vietnam, although I'm certain that certain political constituencies in Washington would love to see that happen. But I don't think that's really the motive, the driving factor that explains U.S. policy towards Syria today.
Well, I think given, you know, my understanding of the government and how it operates in terms of foreign policy would indicate that it's much less likely to involve in to be capable of Machiavellian strategy as opposed to blundering into some sort of incompetence, which was, of course was the hallmark of Iraq. But it does seem that maybe if there's any strategy, it's basically to wait for both sides to exhaust themselves. But nevertheless, it is always a danger of this because it's a proxy war of the whole region igniting, isn't there? I mean, isn't that the subtext, the proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran? And that seems to be not going away. And my understanding from talking to specialists, particularly on Iraq, is that Iraq is the weak link now, that Al-Qaeda in Iraq, you know, of course, the Bush administration tried to sell the war in part on the phony idea that there was an Al-Qaeda presence in Iraq. Well, now there is. I mean, and
yeah, no, that's one of the ironies, that there was no Al-Qaeda presence in Iraq, as everyone, I think, agrees. Prior to 2003, but as a result of the U.S. Intervention and occupation of Iraq, Al-Qaeda now has a very strong presence, and I think one of the most underreported and under-discussed news stories that really tells you a lot about the legacy of U.S. foreign policy in many ways in Iraq is the fact that 1,000 people were killed in the month of July alone. I mean, every day we sort of see a report buried maybe on page 3 or 4 or sometimes further in the newspaper that another 50 people, another 60 people have been killed, largely by these Al-Qaeda-linked operations in Iraq. And, this seems to be continuing without any end in sight. And it's so routine now that we've sort of become desensitized to it. But if anything, it seems like Al-Qaeda is much stronger now today than it ever was. And I think that really bodes ill for the future of the country, and it really raises serious questions about how long the country can hold together under this ferocious sort of attack of ongoing terrorist strikes against the civilian population.
And it's also against the Iranian-backed government of Maliki, who has clearly mishandled the situation. So you do have – I brought the Iraq issue up to fill out a broader picture of a kind of regional proxy war that is anything but under control. I mean, we talked earlier about how the Syrian situation, the U.S. is sort of mainly sort of feels that it's contained, but I'm suggesting that the whole situation is pretty tenuous, isn't it? And Iraq seems to be the weak link.
Oh, I agree. No, I agree. I mean, just looking at where things stand today, I mean, in the short term and in the long term, it seems like if anyone is going to be the victor here, it's going to be these Al-Qaeda-linked elements who are growing in strength in Syria and seem to be sort of operating under new energy in Iraq. And it really does, raise serious questions about the future of the Maliki government, about the future stability of the country. How long can this country in Iraq hold together under such a withering sort of attack by a revitalized Al-Qaeda movement? And so the entire region, not just Iraq, but also Syria, seems to be headed in a very dark picture. And I don't think anyone really has a clear sense of where things are headed. I think there's a sense from the United States that they are, they've withdrawn from Iraq and left sort of a very negative legacy behind. But also in the case of Syria, there's no serious attempt to intervene. The United States has basically turned over policy to its allies in the Gulf, and they're sort of the main players who are, I think, intervening and shaping events in Syria as outside regional interveners. But of course, Iran is on the opposite side, and this process is simply spinning out of control. There's no sense of where this is going to end, and so I think the prognosis looking forward looks incredibly grim for the entire region.
Well, just in closing, back to the domestic Iranian situation, I mentioned that most of the questions came from the foreign press at today's press conference with Iran's new leader. But there were some questions from local reporters. He didn't take questions from the conservative Iranian press, but he did got a broad range of questions about poverty and inflation and the economy. And regional stability and corruption. And my understanding is, you know, his recent remarks on Quds Day, the day that the official holiday where the Iranian regime celebrates Quds, but Jerusalem, the anti-Israel day, if you will, the remarks that he made there there were various interpretations. I'm not sure what he did say. He certainly got a rebuke from Netanyahu in Israel, but did he once again call for Israel's destruction like Ahmadinejad routinely did?
No, I mean, that's what Benjamin Netanyahu wants us to believe. And in fact, when Netanyahu in his office was challenged over their claims that this is another Ahmadinejad sort of moment here, Netanyahu's office had to sort of admit that they had a wrong translation. What in fact he did say, and I think the language and the metaphor that Rouhani used was actually one that is opening a new chapter in Iran's relationship toward the outside world and a new attitude, at least rhetorically, from the Iranian regime toward Israel. And he used the metaphor of an old wound, that the question of Palestine and the creation of Israel, which is viewed by many people in the region as a colonial settler state that was built on the ruins of a Palestinian society, he used that phrase, use the metaphor of an old wound. And, you know, I think the wound is something that needs to heal. It sort of suggests that, you know, these calls, these incendiary calls about wiping Israel on the map, that's part of Iran's foreign policy past, not its future. So I think if you look at his statements on Jerusalem Day, they are, I think, they're much better suited. I mean, they're not ideal by any stretch of the imagination. But I think he did, as the president of the Islamic Republic of Iran, capture, I think, a broad view and sentiment within the Islamic world toward the question of Palestine and toward the question of Israel. And this is, I think, something that many American listeners are not used to hearing, because there's a sense that we view Israel from our own sort of history of sort of anti-Semitism, the need to find justice for historic anti-Semitism and persecution of world Jewry. But, you know, from the Islamic world's point of view, they view the Israel-Palestine conflict through the prism of the dispossession and the ongoing subjugation of the Palestinian people. And that's what Rouhani was, I think, trying to articulate. And I think those words are ones that I think, you know, they do stand up to scrutiny. I think Iran has a right to sort of speak its mind on how it views the Israel-Palestine conflict. Of course, the actions and the attitudes of previous leaders calling for Israel's destruction, I think, needs to be opposed and challenged, because those are clear violations of international law. But I think Rouhani's statements on this question, I think, suggest that this new government that is in power now is going to be very different from the Ahmadinejad government. It's the atmospherics, the attitude, the people coming into the key ministries are going to be much more professional, much more sophisticated, and I think there's going to be new opportunities here to engage with Iran. Let's hope that everyone can bring their best face forward, and that these outstanding issues can be resolved, because if they are resolved, then everyone, I think, in the Middle East and in the world will really benefit.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Nada Hashemi.
Happy to be with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Nada Hashemi, who's the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Kobel School of International Studies at the University of Denver, and he's the author of a new book out soon, The Syria Dilemma. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with William Gould, who negotiated the 1992-1993 salary disputes between Major League Baseball Player Association and the Major League Baseball Owners, and is the author of Bargaining with Baseball, Labor Relations in an Age of Prosperous Turmoil.